Welcome back to the London Futurist podcast. It is nearly 40 years since our guest today, pioneering transhumanist Natasha Vitamore, created the first version of the Transhumanist Manifesto. Since that time, Natasha has established numerous core perspectives, values, and actions in the global transhumanist family. Natasha joins us in this episode to share her observations on how transhumanism has evolved over the decades and to reflect on her work in building the movement, from practice-based approaches, scientific contributions, and theoretical innovations. Areas we expect to explore include: how has Natasha's work seeded the global growth of transhumanism? What are the main advances over the years that she particularly values? And what are some of the disappointments? Then we'll look to the future. What are her hopes and expectations for the next 10 years of transhumanism? Natasha, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dalev and Caleb. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you with us, Natasha.
Natasha, perhaps we could start by celebrating some breakthrough accomplishments. Can you pick out one or two key highlights of your involvement in the growth of transhumanism?
Yes, it's a little bit daunting because I have to think back over decades. But what comes to mind are two that I think lie outside my own personal needs and desires to look at the bigger picture, which is what transhumanism is all about. First, what stands out as a highlight is back in 2004, a group of renowned bioethicists contributed to the Beyond Therapy report that was published and claimed gene editing, stem cells, and other forms of human enhancement were immoral and unethical. To make a stand, I produced and chaired the Vital Progress Summit online with key transhumanists to address this Beyond Therapy report and the absurdity of it, because our vision was for the ethical use of technology to help in longevity and to overcome disease. Interestingly enough, resulting in our ideas came the proactionary principle, which is a known method for dealing with the pros and cons of biomedical interventions. So the outcome of this summit that I produced and chaired was to bring a group of scholarly transhumanists together to argue our points as finessed as possible as to why the Beyond Therapy report was going in the wrong direction, like foresight and strategic thinking, et cetera, about the future, and why we needed to respond to it. And I'm very glad about that. It was an idea that I had for a while, and I was glad to see it come to fruition. The timing was just right on that. Another one I think is important, looking back over time, was back in 2011, I remember reading an academic journal that MetaNexus Institute had produced. And I was surprised to read a group of valued scholars like N. Catherine Hales and Don Ide and Andrew Pickering writing disparaging comments about transhumanism from the postmodernist academic camp. In their misrepresentation of transhumanism, I was shocked. I was working on my doctorate at the time, and I really was offended by this personally and as a transhumanist. So I called up the editor-in-chief, and I spoke to him and the managing editor, and we discussed a response. And interestingly enough, this involvement, am I calling them and saying we need to respond to this because these comments are irregular, they're totally off the mark, and for academics, for scholars to be writing this type of stuff, it's teaching wrong information. So what happened was that I was invited to be the guest editor of a responsive special published journal, and I also included about six other transhumanists to respond to these various comments made by the academics in opposition to transhumanism. It became the first and most known academic debate among scholars in the fields of philosophy and the humanities and future about transhumanism, and it resulted also in a published book called Transhumanism and Its Critics. Today, I get more notations from published journals in the field of education with references and citations to this book. I think that's really wonderful. It's remarkable to get it out there and to have been so responsive to these things.
Let's backtrack a moment, because we haven't actually defined transhumanism in this discussion so far. You've mentioned it's looking at the bigger picture, the ethical use of technology. You've mentioned that various academics, strangely, have misinterpreted it in various ways that you described as being irregular, disparaging. What does transhumanism mean to you?
To me, transhumanism means the continued evolvability of our species to overcome limitations through the ethical use of technology and evidence-based science. I see it as a worldview, as well as a philosophy, but it's the worldview and movement I have been most interested in. A large part of that stems from my own background, having grown up in a certain way and seeing that nothing had worked. No religions, no meditations, no type of enlightenment had really gotten people beyond the biases and the discriminations and the angst that humans have, which was necessary for survival, to be sure, the fight or flight syndrome from our reptilian brain in our brainstem. And that psychology has been important. But I've always felt that the psychology that is needed for the future of humanity is certainly a more critical, visionary sensibility with more foresight and doability to look at all situations and to choose the most healthy, beneficial resolve. Basically, transhumanism stems from humanism without the anti-human evolution aspect there, but it's all about human evolution and becoming, I think, more humane species. That's for me in any case.
Visionary, foresight, healthy vision, with critical thinking. So why do people object to transhumanism?
Because the tools that the transhumanist worldview or philosophy proposes are the same tools that were once verboten and are today mainstream. For example, when transhumanism first started arriving as a global movement in the early 1990s, artificial intelligence was science fiction. Super longevity was something that was considered selfish or unethical. People were supposed to live within a certain shelf life or time frame, and to try to seek beyond that time frame was not something that was truly accepted. Anti-aging was kind of an outlier or fringe. People were afraid of biotechnologies, genetic engineering, stem cells, human enhancement largely. I think that the normalcy that had been used in scientism had really sequestered people to a pretty narrow, boxed-in perspective of what a human is supposed to be.
Yeah, which is quintessentially a pessimistic view of humanity, and I always think transhumanism is a much more optimistic view of what's possible for humanity. I strongly suspect that the optimistic outlook has gotten a lot more traction, a lot more people would agree with it than did 20 years ago. But I still think it's probably a minority. I still think if you could line all the people up in the world and ask them, do you broadly think it's a good idea for humans to augment ourselves and improve ourselves? Probably have a majority say, nope, we should be natural. We should make the best of what God or evolution have given us. Do you sense that, or are you more optimistic than me? Do you think most people are becoming transhumanist?
I'm a practical optimist, and as a pragmatic person, I tend to agree with you. I think that the large populace in the world, no matter what geographical location, what country, what ideology, are largely religious, and religion offers a scapegoat. It offers either life after death or reincarnation or some type of other world after death. So there's that on the one hand. On the other hand, there's the sense of what is natural. But whenever I'm interviewed on that particular topic, my response has been and continues to be, what was natural yesterday is unnatural today, and what was unnatural yesterday has become natural today. Once we thought having a device that we could look at that might interact with our cognitive properties was human enhancement, awful and unnatural. Today, the large portion of the world have devices. They're called smartphones, and they interact with them, and they are enhancements and augmentations to our biological spheres. But I do think the more mainstream transhumanism becomes, meaning that people see that they don't have to age and die so quickly, that we do not have to suffer, that we're not here to suffer, that the prejudice and biases of yesterday are becoming less fluent and there's less tolerance for them. We're saying no more readily, like I did with the Meta Nexus Journal and I did with the Beyond Therapy report. When you see something that is so misplaced, it is our responsibility to say no. There's a level of objectivity that must come in there so that we're not being egoists about it and not being self-centered, but we're looking at the larger picture. And that requires an evolved mindfulness. It's a maturation. I think that humanity will mature to a level where we don't need these attitudes of narcissism and egocentricities and wanting to be famous or wanting to be popular or how we look. And I think that it'll be more generated into a keener sensibility. And I think that's an evolving in our psychology. But our frontal lobe hasn't evolved much over the past many, many, many centuries. And hopefully with artificial intelligence, we will become more perceptive, kinder, more aware people.
Perhaps we could look a bit at the variety of things you have brought to the table here, as well as being a designer and an educator, a philosopher, and a movement builder. You've carried out some important scientific research to help broaden people's understanding of the possibilities of science. Could you tell us and our listeners a bit more about that?
Yes, sure. What's interesting is that I've always had this almost like nagging curiosity about memory. And one of my favorite things from childhood is I would say to my siblings, I've come from a large family, and friends, remember when we did this or remember when we did that? So memory has always had this a delightful feeling for me. But I've had great concern as well as I've aged over the years that the increased level of dementia and early onset Alzheimer's and memory loss amongst people who, as we age, all of us as we age, is on the rise. So that concerns me. I took a very definitive approach to my scientific research. Again, I come from a family of largely doctors. I have a natural inclining for research and science. The issue of memory was profound, and I decided that I would work with a field that was really well known as reproduction, infertility. And it was one that was very familiar to me. I'd gone through infertility myself, so it was a natural. The scientific research that I brought together that dealt with reproduction, that dealt with memory, and that dealt with looking at a future technology and science for biomedical intervention is the field of cryobiology. So I worked within the field of cryobiology with a simple animal called a C. elegans, a very renowned animal in the biomedical field. And I trained this simple animal, I would say hundreds of them.
It's a small little worm, isn't it?
Yes, it's a nematode. It's a microscopic worm. It's easily trainable through sensory, through sound, through light, through temperature. It doesn't have a brain, but it has 302 neurons. What I did was I trained the baby worms, the small nematodes, to go to their feeding location with a particular chemical, an odorant, that had a specific smell, so they would associate smell with their food. When they matured to the adult stage, they always went to that particular side of the petri dish that had the odorant with their food. At that stage, I put them in a cryobiology biostasis form called vitrification, basically in cryonics. I vitrified the worms for an amount of time, and then I revived them, brought them back to life from stasis, and put them back in the petri dishes, the many hundreds of worms, and tested to see if they remembered that particular smell, that odorant, with their food in association. It's very Pavlovian. And they did. 99% of the worms went directly to the food. Some of them didn't make it for various reasons. The beautiful part of that is my research was a success in establishing long-term memory can persist through biostasis as a breakthrough in evidencing new knowledge in the field of cryobiology, specifically in cryonics or biostasis.
That's fascinating. And what temperature were they stored at when they were in stasis?
They're at that vitrification stage of minus 400 degrees. Vitrification isn't frozen. It's a process that's used with embryos, with eggs and sperm. It's a very delicate time-based process. So it made the research even more tenable. Working with microscopic animals was not an easy task, but the beauty of it afforded an easeability because they are beautiful, simple animals, and I loved watching them. They kind of swim like a dance in the agar, in the jelly-like material in the petri dish.
This fits the broader picture that science and technology will allow us to do things which previously people couldn't imagine. The idea that people might be cryopreserved and then reanimated at some future stage strikes some people as science fiction, but you're helping to demonstrate at least some parts of it are scientifically plausible, and therefore opening people's minds to a more optimistic future.
Thank you.
You've talked about some of the things that you count as accomplishments. Could you reflect on some of the things you perhaps with hindsight had wished had gone differently?
I think it's important to consider the time frame in which I was brought up, which was the 1950s, as part of a generation of women who had to, maybe perhaps you might say, fight twice as hard to receive any level of accomplishment or reward for the work done at a time of true inequity amongst men and women. I'm not getting on any woke bandwagon here, but I think it's important from my background specifically as a transhumanist. And what I had to go through. I lived in a world where my father didn't want me to go to college. I had to sell my blood, worked three jobs, waited tables at night, worked very hard until I became an award student and completed my undergraduate degree off campus without attending school. One day, I lived with the Navajo Indians, did my research based on the Navajo way, and produced a series of performative visual filmic projects based on that. As a radical, I grew up as a radical. I was feisty. I didn't like this unfairness. I didn't understand it. Most of my family, again, are medical doctors, and I didn't want to go into that profession because I knew I couldn't be a strong campaigner or voice for transhumanism. It was too rigid at that time. So I decided the arts, performance, filmmaking, video, writing, poetry, all those areas would provide a venue for me. If I could have done it differently or changed, I couldn't. I am a product of the generation that I grew up in, but that doesn't limit us where we come from. It's our responsibility to soar ahead and to find our own trek to get to where we need to go. And it took me a long time to do that because of the circumstances of the times. Finally, I wised up and I thought, okay, the hell with it. Just go with the flow. Just keep my mouth shut and just continue. So what I did was I stayed within the arts world of entertainment in Los Angeles as I studied, and I studied very hard. I went to numerous conferences on technology, on science, on anything on longevity, biomedical. My brother really helped me with this. I learned as much as I could while I stayed as a voice. But I think that my shyness got in the way of me claiming my position. And I look today at certain people who go around with an immortality bus or say I'm an entrepreneur or I created. I really was in the trenches. I really did the work. So one thing I would do differently is nothing. I would never borrow someone else's vision and put my name on it. I would never copy or plagiarize someone else's work and claim it as my own. I've always been a true artist in that sense. And that I am proud of, because in the art world, it is your imagination, your creativity, your vision, your voice that is the honesty, the truth. While I'm also a theoretician and an academic and a partial scientist, I think that the values that I hold stem from the arts.
One thing that shines out, Natasha, as you talk, is that you definitely haven't lost your feistiness, which we should all be very thankful for. Our generation is one in which women have come on an incredible journey, but it's very far from over. There's still a ridiculous shortage of women in many walks of life. And sadly, in transhumanism and the sort of the wider community of people who think carefully about the future and encourage all of us to take the future seriously and to whatever extent is possible to guide us towards a good future rather than a bad one, there is still a particular underrepresentation of women in that field. Do you have any ideas why that would be?
Yeah, I think for the reasons I just said. Women look to men for approval, and men look to men for approval. And that's slowly changing, but it's still here. I've seen it over and over again. Yes, I did write the Transhumanist Manifesto, but I remember when I first wrote it, someone who I'm also always asked about, my dear friend and colleague, FM Esfandiari, or FM 2030, he was totally against me writing that. He didn't like it. He didn't want me to create a movement, and I was adamant about creating a movement.
Is that because you're a woman?
I think so. I took the attention off him.
Wow.
And I'm being perfectly honest here, and some people may boo me for that.
You've just shot my idol, Natasha.
Well, all people surely are complex. You can see admirable things in people without necessarily saying everything about them is admirable.
Sure.
Yeah. So I would say that while he was certainly exceedingly handsome and charismatic and an Olympian athlete and a diplomat with the United Nations and came from a very astute family, he was quite different from my many other men friends. And so I left him because of that. I did not like that. And finally, I got my head screwed on correctly. Although he did encourage me to do a lot of things, the TV show I hosted and produced in Los Angeles called Transcentury Transhuman Update, I was on the future, and it was very successful, reached 100,000 people, and it also aired in Telluride, Colorado. He encouraged me to do that, and he was my guest on the first few episodes where I was really not good. It was first time on camera in that way outside being an actor, so it was really hard for me. But the more successful I became, the less admiration he had for my work. Whereas there's others like Ray Kurzweil and Max Moore that really honor women and our work. But women are the same way too. Competition's competition. I do think that if I could have done something differently, I would have hired a publicist. And I didn't, because that was not part of the... My father was in advertising. I didn't think I needed to advertise myself. I thought people should see who I was. And that wasn't ego. That was just how I grew up. I didn't think I had to go out and tell people who I was. I thought they would just see what I was doing. But I think that's an immature, naive sensibility. Just because I came from Telluride or New York and with my background, that people would automatically go, oh, well, she's the, you know, whatever. No, that's not true. Sometimes you just have to get out there and really do that part of the work. I was behind the scenes doing the writing, the thinking, the producing, the hosting, the vision. I just didn't think I had to promote it as well. But what I love today about what women and men are doing is that they've become entrepreneurs. I wasn't an entrepreneur in that sense, in that business type of sense. I didn't have my pitch because I was doing the work. I didn't think I needed to. I think there are lots of women in transhumanism. They're just not going around trying to use it to make themselves famous like some other people might. I just hosted a group of women called Visionary Women of Super Longevity, and it was packed with women. They were all transhumanists. They're CEOs of corporations, advocates, enthusiasts. Amazing women. So I think that they're there. It's just that we default to inviting men. There's so many people I love and admire, but I think that there's always a woman there. You take a look at Rodin, there was Camille. You take a look at Sartre, there was Simone. When you think of Sartre and existentialism, you don't think of Simone de Beauvoir, but she wrote The Seven Sex.
As the saying goes, behind every great man, there's a woman rolling her eyes.
But I'm not angry about it. And one thing is, I'm so fortunate to have met Max Moore. I had already written the manifesto. I was already a chronicist. I was already gone to space camp. I wanted to be an astronaut. I'd already done all these different things when I met Max. And he's always treated me as an equal. There's never, ever been any competitiveness. And that's what I love about him. We want to see each other aspire. And when we see each other doing something that may not be our best, we try to encourage each other to be better.
That's an Oxford graduate for you.
Yeah.
For those who don't know Max, we should maybe just mention he was one of the philosophers behind the Extropy Institute and, by many accounts, basically the creator of transhumanism in its modern form.
Yeah, as a philosophy, yes, indeed. We are very different. We come from very different backgrounds. He wrote the philosophy as a philosophy. He also wrote the Extropian philosophy. Transhumanism, in his view, is a set of philosophies. You can have different views within it, but transhumanism itself has its tenets. For example, it's not being Pollyanna, it's being an optimist with sensibility, a critical thinker and a visionary, to see we can overcome the limitations that have been indoctrinated into our culture and our societies throughout the world that we live to a certain age, we reproduce, we die.
That openness, that support for morphological freedom, the diversity, is one of the really admirable aspects of transhumanism as I see it as well.
Yes, I think so as well. You know, it's interesting in this time and age when there's so many people talking about biases and prejudice, there's nothing more prejudiced against than longevity. There's such a bias towards those of us who have the transhumanist aim of overcoming disease and living longer, healthier lives. And I think that that disdain filters into transhumanism as what in the early 21st century was called the world's most dangerous idea, based on a prejudice, a bias, by a person who used their moral judgment to instigate a rhetoric in opposition to transhumanism, and that was very difficult to overcome, but we did. I think that transhumanism continues to grow. It continues to progress forward. It continues to use that gyroscope to re-steer like a cybernetics. And I think that that's probably one of the most essential and important tenets or values of transhumanism, to see where there needs to be an error correction and to not be dogmatic, to say, okay, this needs to change. We were heading this way. Okay, times have changed. The sciences, technologies, the moral compass has changed. We need to go in this direction.
I'm not being entirely flippant by saying that since the person who said that transhumanism was the world's most dangerous idea was Francis Fukuyama, and his previous great statement, which he's best known for, was saying that history had come to an end when the Cold War was over. I'm not sure why anybody would take that source of opinions very seriously. But actually, in a sense, he wasn't entirely wrong in that as we go forward and technology accelerates, we're going to be changing ourselves more and more. And I think there is clearly going to have to be an enormous change in attitude among a lot of people who currently think it's a bad idea. They currently think what's natural is right. Okay, you can have glasses, you can have cochlear implants, so far and no further. Anything else is changing our basic human nature, and that's wrong. And that's going to have to change. And that sort of change, that sort of earthquake in conventional wisdom, causes difficulty. People struggle with change. So in a sense, Fukuyama wasn't entirely wrong, not because the idea itself is dangerous, but the change that it's going to require, that will be disruptive, really disruptive.
Well said. Well said, Caleb. I agree with you on that.
So let's look at the future. Let's see how this might evolve further. Because you are executive director of Humanity Plus, the international transhumanist movement. On its website, it's got statements such as elevating the human condition, advancing science and technology for a better future. What do you think's likely to happen, and what would you hope is going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years as regards these aspirations and the movement?
Humanity Plus has a fiduciary duty and a responsibility to educate because it's a 501c3 nonprofit. So that is the core goal that I'm looking at. How can we be better educators? What can we do to inform others about all areas, the pros, the cons, the good, the bad, the challenges, the benefits, etc. The projects that we're currently doing will only expand. Currently, we have the H Plus Academy Roundtable discussion and debate. That's very successful. It continues on. That's free for anyone who wants to go to it. We also have the Transvision Summits around the world that we help sponsor. You have held several of them yourself, David, that are quite amazing in London, and we have them in Spain and so many different countries, probably hold one in the United States, in Austin, Texas in 2023, hopefully. So we have those types of conferences as well, summits where we bring people in to talk about the current issues. We have the Transhumanist Studies, which is affiliated with Humanity Plus, and that is a very cost-effective, it's almost a free, informative project that I put together because I've been writing curriculum for university for years, so I can put curriculum together quite easily and fast because I've had to while standing up and drinking my coffee. So the curriculum, the beauty of it, it's based on, it's not my opinion, it's not my view, it's all the evidence I could find, writings, films, videos, books, stories, etc. And it tells the story of transhumanism, how it started, where it's headed. So that's good. And also every Friday, there is a Transhumanist Studies group that meets online. People from all over the world come to it. It's small, but I like that because it's more like a graduate program. And that's the accelerator, the knowledge accelerator, where we discuss issues as they're occurring. I'm going to have a new publication coming out that Humanity Plus will be one of the sponsors of, and that's called Rejuvenation Revolution. And that will be a scholarly type of periodical, small and sweet and to the point. And the byline, no noise. So overcoming the noise, getting away from the noise of the longevity community, which is growing by leaps and bounds, and not all the information that you find at conferences or in publications is really on point. Largely, it's about selling a product or a way for investors to invest their money.
You're going to be busy. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, busy. But the most important thing, David, we're doing a lot of work in Africa because it is a really amazing continent and it's where humanity evolved out of in Ethiopia. If you look at evolutionary progress, we have a couple of projects in South Africa, Afro-Longevity, which we're working with. We have projects in Nigeria where we have faculty, university faculty, who's working on the rejuvenation revolution. And then we also have a project that we're sponsoring in Ethiopia called DigiTruck, Girls Can Code. Now it's Anyone Can Code. And that is teaching coding to remote locations in Africa. So it's all about education and we want to see this grow.
And just in case people are unsure, you're saying that there is interest in transhumanism, in super longevity in Nigeria and Ethiopia? Because occasionally people say this is a white man's philosophy.
I know, and that's so wrong. If you allow me to go back to my scientific research and my own life experience, my scientific research was on a methodology that had been used and respected and known in reproduction and infertility called vitrification of embryo, sperm, and egg. Because that's so well known, I decided to go that route with memory. That's a woman's role, largely, to reproduce. For the time being, it is, let's say, until we have exo-wombs and other forms of reproduction, but largely it's a woman's contribution to our species. Fundamentally, longevity would be important to women because women are caretakers as well. There are more women in the longevity industry and the field than people realize. They're just, again, not out there trying to turn transhumanism or longevity into a business for themselves, for their own recognition. They are behind the scenes doing the work, much like I have over the years. Probably they just need a little bit more attention or a little bit light shine on them a little bit more.
That's what we can do.
So in Nigeria and Africa, yes, Nigeria, we have a strong interest in super longevity in Nigeria, South Africa, definitely. The CEO of TAFS is putting on the Afro Longevity Conference in August of 2023. That is led by a very astute woman. But I don't like it being about gender. I think that when people have this binary thinking, white male men, it starts with a limitation. So just even that mindset is what we're trying to get away from with scientism or postmodernism, or I should say postmodernist dogma. or with the black, white, yes, no, right, wrong. I think whenever anyone says, oh, it's just a white male's world, that's binary thinking, that's prejudice. I think you almost have to call that prejudice from the onset, because once you say bias or prejudice, people stop in their tracks.
Natasha Vitamoa, we're talking about transcending prejudices, transcending restricted mindsets, transcending limits. You have given us a great deal to think about, and we wish you every success in your future work.
Thank you very much, Natasha.
Thank you, Caleb. Thank you, David.
Thank you.